back together, you and I, kicking off a brand new month, June 1st, 2023. On Connecticut Today, we featured news of the state's minimum wage increasing again, now to $15 an hour. Connecticut Commuter Rail Council Chairman Jim Gilday chatted about possible Metro North service cutbacks and more. $15 an hour. That's what the state's minimum wage is now, $15 an hour. Another scheduled hike in the minimum wage has kicked in here on this Thursday, the 1st of June, 6/1/2023, right here on Connecticut Today, $15 an hour. That is what businesses are required under Connecticut state labor law to pay somebody. Now, you may sit there and say, well, that's good, you know? Hey, that's not bad. And if somebody, I mean, let's do the math here. If somebody is working a now minimum wage job in the state and they are working that for 2,080 hours, which is how you figure a full-time job, that means somebody at minimum, in a minimum wage situation here, is making $31,200. All right? $31,200. Now, if you are a single person with very little or no debt, let's say you're not paying a car loan or something, let's say you don't have student loans, let's say you're very careful, as some of us are and some of us aren't, as to how you spend your money. Is it possible to survive on that? Yeah, I guess it is if you figure you have very little, if any, tax bite on that, and you're probably going to take home your net. I mean, if you're grossing $31,200, you're probably taking home, I don't know, 20, 21 grand, 22 grand. Not a lot of money. I understand that. That's I certainly couldn't live on that with my obligations and long-term debt and all that. And a bunch of us couldn't. But the idea here in raising this is a statement from Governor Ned Lamont, who said, quote, no one should work a full-time job and live in poverty. And therein lies what I wanted to begin talking about today, working with you here on this Thursday. We have a lot of stuff coming up, updates from the Capitol, a couple of guests coming up later on in the show. When I was growing up, back in like the 1830s, I'm kidding, I'm not that old, but getting there, no one expected you, if you were a first-time worker, or no employer was expected to pay anything much above the minimum wage if you were first starting out. Remember, a minimum wage job, and I'll tell you right now, when I started, my minimum wage, and I'd say this to, you know, my son and young folks here around the station, and they look at me like I had, like I've got four eyes. I only have three. But they give me the four-eyed look. And I started, and it was $2.65 an hour. $2.65. My first couple of minimum wage jobs, and again, we had a family store, too, so, you know, when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, before I turned 16, I would go in and help my dad after school on a Friday or on Saturday. And he paid me. And I think on a Saturday, he gave me like 15 or 20 bucks. It was a busy day. Sorry, you folks at the IRS. I wasn't doing a tax form for 20 bucks a week back when I was 12. Come after me. But, and I know if I mention that today and somebody's like, oh my God, Pacelli brothers. Oh no, the Pacellis engaged in child labor. No, we didn't. It helped make that stuff help me become the person I am today. Anyway, you know, back then, $2.65 an hour was actually the first, well, my first real on the books pay was $2.65 an hour, and that would be when I was 16, so that would have been sometime back in 1977. Yikes. were in the land of 8-tracks and cassettes back in 1977. Anyway, $2.65 an hour. And I didn't work any full-time jobs back then, but I did work every so often for one of our neighbors, she worked in a blueprint copying company. Special companies have the special accoutrement. If you have a contractor and they take a job, they need 300, 400, 500 sets of blueprints. So I did that for a while, and I did a couple of odd jobs, helping out doing inventory through the friend of a friend. That was all on the books. Okay. But back then, minimum wage was not meant for you or I or anybody to live on. And it's interesting that Governor Lamont issues a statement that is not in and of itself earth-shattering, but it presents a problem. And this is what I wanted to start with. And whether you agree with this or not, I'd love to hear from you at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So the governor says, quote, no one should work a full-time job and live in poverty, unquote. He continued, quote, again, for too long, while the nation's economy grew, the income of the lowest-earning workers stayed flat, making existing pay disparities even worse and preventing hard-working families from obtaining financial security. Okay, let's peel this apart here for just a bit. Now, I know it's not 1965, 1970, 1975 anymore. But minimum wage jobs in this country were once made for basically young people, right? I'm sure there were older folks who worked minimum wage jobs because they had to. Listen, if the bottom fell out on me and this and the other stuff I do, I'd take a minimum wage job, absolutely. But here's the problem. And the minute you say something about, well, the minimum wage might be too high, you get descended upon by the people who say, oh, you want people to starve and die. No, I don't. Nothing of the sort. But here's the consideration that nobody ever listens to, or at least lawmakers never listen to. Because let's face it, a lot of people in Washington, a lot of people in Hartford, as well-intentioned as they are, they've never met a payroll. And I'm not saying there are people on the left and the right, whatever, in Hartford, in Washington, they wouldn't have the first clue about meeting a payroll. They may be very bright people, but rarely do you have a lawmaker that's got to look down at the end of a week or the end of every 2 weeks, twice a month, or at the end of the month and say, well, these are my labor costs, these are my utility costs, these are my material costs, these are my fixed costs, insurance and taxes and everything. So what can I adjust here? Because I'm not doing real well. I'm okay. My nose is above water, barely. You can barely see the two nostrils there. My head's above water, maybe, but we have to do something here. And here's the problem I have, not necessarily with raising the minimum wage. I get it. I understand that. And with that bigger wage comes purchasing power, so some of the money goes back in the economy. I get that. But what I rail against is lawmakers with these big, grandiose statements. You know, like the governor said, well, no one should work in a full-time job and live in poverty. Okay. So, governor, if the answer to that is paying somebody a minimum of $32,000, $33,000 a year, and you have a business with fixed costs, do politicians, lawmakers, and those among us who like to bloviate on this stuff, do they understand that the more you pay an individual worker, for a lot of businesses, not everyone, you know, a lot of businesses have more money that they could spend on labor, but for whatever reason, they choose not to. But do lawmakers understand that every time they let loose with a pronouncement of what a business should be paying somebody and what businesses can and do pay people, oftentimes puts stress on those businesses? Now, for example, and again, excuse my crude figures on this, and Steve, hang on, and other folks on the phone, we'll get to you momentarily. But riddle me this. Now, our minimum wage is $15 an hour. Okay. So that means somebody can work a full-time job at whatever, a hamburger joint, a coffee shop, whatever, someplace where you would look and kind of realize there are minimum wage jobs there. And they would make $31,200 a year, roughly, depending upon some vacation fill-in, whether they get paid for the holidays or whatever. So let's say $31,200. So the government is telling you, all right, you must pay that. So the workers, the employer is saying, well, okay then, if I have to designate this many hours a year to that wage, I can only employ so many people. And this is the conundrum. And believe me, there are countries that don't have minimum wages, and they do just fine. Now, they're not the size of the U.S., I get it. But there are countries, there are entities, modern societies on this planet that don't have a minimum wage. They let the market set the minimum wage. Should we be doing that here? Or should we at least be experimenting with that here? Because when the government says, Mr. Home Improvement Guy or Mr. Record Shop Owner or Mr. Cafe Owner, you must pay a minimum here, and that guy or gal or husband or wife or team, whatever, that owns the place only has so much money that they could set aside for labor, it chokes off how many people they could give a job to. So here's the thing. Here's my question, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Let's say this guy or gal or whatever says, okay, if it's $15 an hour, I can only afford one person, right? I can pay one person 140-hour opening or 140-hour slot for 40 hours a week, 2,080 hours a year, $15 an hour. But if I was paying $7.50 an hour, could I instead? Now, there's no guarantee that anybody would take the job at $7.50. See what I'm saying? But because that guy would have, or that gal would have to pay one person, a minimum of $15 an hour. It cuts down their ability to pay perhaps maybe more people. In other words, what do? Do you pay one person $15 an hour and rely on that one person or two people at $15 an hour, but they only get 20 hours a week of work? Or do you pay two people $7.50 an hour for 40 hours a week? You've added a person from the labor force. See, this is why I rail and I push back at and now some politicians know what they're talking about and some don't. But sometimes, you know, the magnanimous pronunciations about what minimum wages should be are set by people that never have any skin in the game. They just don't. What do you think of all this? The idea of a minimum wage, now the Connecticut is $15 an hour. It went up again. It's going to go up with the cost of living. Is this a burden on business? Or do businesses say, okay, I'll pay $15 an hour, but I can only segment so many hours at $15 an hour. If you let me pay 10 an hour or 8 or 10, I could designate more hours of labor here. All right, let's talk about the trains. Now, we've heard a lot of conflicting stuff here. There are cuts coming to Metro North. There aren't cuts coming to Metro North. Oh, it's only in the middays. Mornings and afternoons won't be affected. And then we hear now it will be affected. So what are we to figure here? The governor says, hey, Monday and Friday, there's nobody on the trains. Okay. There may be a $40 million cut coming to the Metro North budget. Joining us right now is Jim Gilday. He's the president of the Connecticut Commuter Rail Council. Hey, Jim, it's Paul here on WICC. How are you?
I am well, Paul. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great. I wanted to have you on because I know you've been in the discussions here and I see your name bounced about. So, Jim, let me ask you first off, what are you hearing? Are you hearing anything from your sources, from the MTA, Metro North, the governor? Are there cuts coming or not? Or do we not know?
Oh, I think I certainly think that the budget numbers that both the governor's office has proposed and that has actually come out of the Appropriations Committee does call for a 14% cut in service on the New Haven line, and it calls for dropping the Shoreline East from 66% service to about 40% service. So without question, both the legislature's budget and the governor's budget would definitely cut the service level on the New Haven line and Shoreline.
I'm a little upset, Jim, that we don't seem to be getting, or at least it took us a while before we got the straight story here. And I don't know, Jim, if you've heard anything different, but I guess the head of the MTA came out and said, well, maybe there will be cuts in morning and afternoon drive. And I was talking to Ed Valenti, who heads the conductors union, a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that he had heard on his end that the cuts were going to go beyond the middle of the day. Jim, I just don't get it because I thought rail was important here. I guess it's not.
Well, a couple things. First, I would say part of the issue is Hartford is broken. Mm-hmm. And the way our legislation works is just broken. So our legislators who are pro-rail, but they're facing a situation where they have to either vote for the budget or not vote for the budget. So they have a hard time, you know, voting no because they're walking away from tax cuts. And so Hartford is broken. That's issue number one. Mm-hmm. Issue number two is there will absolutely be cuts to more than just off-peak service. I think if you talk to the people who are in the know, right? And so no offense to the governor's office, no offense to the legislature, but they're not commuters. They don't do scheduling. CDOT doesn't do scheduling. Metro North runs the rail line. Metro North does the scheduling. So when you talk to the experts will tell you, you can't cut 50 trains and just do it during off-peak. You are going to touch peak trains. So I would tell you that anything other than what you hear from Metro North is probably not accurate. That's just, political speak.
Yeah, and Jim Gilday is the guest from the Commuter Rail Council of Connecticut. And Jim, yeah, having ridden Metro North pretty steadily from 2008 right up until the beginning of the pandemic 3 years ago, believe me, I was on those trains 2-3 times a week round trip. And I guess, Jim, the big fear now is Metro North saying, well, listen, we're still going to provide service in mornings and afternoons, but I guess the fear, Jim, is those trains would get uncomfortably crowded at some point.
The cuts are coming at an interesting time. Metro North just set a post-pandemic record. All evidence is that ridership, you just go off of numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Facts drive the story. And the facts are that Metro North is experiencing ridership records. I'm going to say another fact, which I think is important to know.
Sure.
Frequent service builds ridership. And for whatever reason, when it comes to the Shoreline East, they look at it in reverse. They're saying, hey, give us riders and then we'll give you service. But yet, the Waterbury branch line is the first line, think about this for a second, the first line that has exceeded its pre-pandemic ridership numbers. Mm. And interestingly, they did that 3 months after they were given 44% additional service, because service builds ridership. And for whatever reason, well, we know the reason. And it's interesting because as I listened to the news, you talked about zoning laws.
Yeah.
That is the reason, right? So because they're trying to force zoning on the Shoreline East communities, they are destroying the line to prove a point, and that's unfortunate.
Jim Gilday is the guest for a few more minutes, chair of the Commuter Rail Council of Connecticut. And Jim, you're right, and it's unfortunate because I had cited something. In fact, it was in the story, in the Hearst story yesterday that I was referencing. The governor only about a year ago, Jim, you may remember this, he was hailing the expansion of service, and there was more trains being added. And the governor, Jim, remember, he had his 30-30-30 thing, you know, trying to get trains faster into Grand Central, stopping only maybe at Bridgeport and New Haven. And now all of a sudden this, Jim, at a time, like you say, the ridership is up, and we have all this surplus money in Hartford. I just don't get it. What am I missing here?
Two things you're missing. One is when you talk about the governor from a year ago, it was almost a year ago to the day that they hailed the investment of tens of millions of dollars. Tens of millions of dollars are bringing the Shoreline East, the M8 train cars to the Shoreline East. There's a real head scratch. Why would you invest the money? Why would you stand at a press conference? Why would you hail that as some historic achievement and then say, yeah, well, we're going to cut service now? That's the head scratcher, you know, A. And then the only other thing I would tell you is, listen, here's what it's about. And it's really nothing more than this. The Shoreline, if you look at the data, if you look at the Waterbury line, you look at the Hartford line, the amount of houses next to the train station, it's high. The housing density is high. There's plenty of houses near the stations. That is not the case on the Shoreline East. The Shoreline East, conversely, doesn't have as many houses near the train stations. So although the Shoreline East had more riders than the Waterbury branch, and the Waterbury branch still got $110 million for the passing sightings, even though there's more riders, there's not enough. In their mind, they need more houses. So instead of what I would do, although it's clearly, you know, it doesn't matter what I would do, I would have had the zoning discussion first and said, hey, listen, here's really what we want from you. But they're just going hardcore. They're saying, you know what, we're just taking your trains away. You figure the zoning thing out, and then maybe we'll give you the train someday. It's probably not the strategy I would employ, but, you know, certainly I don't get a say.
Yeah, and Jim, finally, I have always thought, and having done shows like this, Jim, for years, and knowing enough people who are in the mix in Hartford and talking to these people, Jim, on and off the record, I can't help but think, Jim, I may be wrong here, but I can't help but think that there might be, from a lot of legislators in Hartford, there might be this attitude of, well, the trains, those are for only the, who rides those trains? The rich people in Fairfield and New Haven County and go out to Old Saybrook and Madison, like, why should I care? I represent Newington. I represent Rocky Hill or Avon. Why should I care? I don't know, Jim, I could be wrong, but I've always thought there's kind of been a laissez-faire about that.
Well, I will tell you two things about Hartford. First, again, I don't want to kill the point. Hartford is broken, right?
Yeah.
So you have to vote on all or nothing for the budget. So so that's the biggest problem, is Hartford is just broken. And so it's hard to vote against the budget. You can't vote against the budget because you're unhappy with the service and then and then say, hey, but I voted for the budget that supported, but you know, tax cuts.
Yeah.
The second thing I would tell you is I think you're right to some degree. I think there's that attitude of, you know, listen, it's not like the New Haven to Grand Central Line. People look at it like, you know, that's moving people to jobs. And there's an economic driver. But people forget that Electric Boat, Pfizer, you know, you have some pretty big employers out that way.
Yeah.
You have tremendous amount of tourist destinations. So they're not just hurting commuters. They're hurting the tourist destinations. They're hurting the restaurants. They're hurting the coffee shops. They're hurting the retail stores. That's who they're hurting as well. They're not just hurting the people that they think are rich commuters who could figure it out themselves. They're hurting every single business that line runs through. They're killing them to prove a zoning point.
Interesting on the zoning angle, Jim. I never thought about that. Jim, thank you. Jim Gilday, who heads the Connecticut Commuter Rail Council. Jim, thanks. Now, you've got my contact info, so anything you hear coming down on this, be sure and get in touch, okay?
I will, Paul. Great talking to you, sir.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. Jim Gilday, who is the chair of the Connecticut Commuter Rail Council. Interesting that Jim thinks, and I've actually heard this from somebody else too, that, you know, the whole zoning mess that's still going on in Hartford as we speak has a little bit of a interwoven dependency with the whole zoning thing that we've been talking about on and off for, what, 2, 3, 4 years here.